loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at three big stories. First, in a major news story, the New York Times reported that President Trump decided last June to fire Special Counsel Robert Mueller because his investigation had moved beyond Russia and alleged collusion. White House Counsel Dan McGahn, according to the report, said he would resign and Trump backed off. Many observers say that firing Mueller would have led to a constitutional crisis. Donald Trump, however, is claiming that the entire story is fake news. Next, President Trump spoke in Davos, Switzerland today at the World Economic Forum. He emphasized his, quote, America First policy and also softened his previously strong anti-globalization stance that had earned him support from some workers and some communities in the United States. Banking elites might not like Trump, but they seem to like his tax plan and his opposition to regulations that favor the environment or workers' rights. And in the last 24 hours, Turkey has had some aggressive words for the United States. In Turkey, will the United States and Turkey clash in the northern part of Syria?
And in our second hour, we talk about the five big stories of the day. First, House Speaker Paul Ryan met yesterday with senior officials of the United Arab Emirates, despite the fact that the UAE is running a torture program in Yemen's secret prisons. U.S. forces have interrogated detainees in the same facilities. Additionally, just today, the UN reported a mass drowning of at least 30 African refugees off the coast of Yemen. Next, the newly appointed police chief of Honduras, long supported by the U.S. military as helping prevent cocaine movement into the U.S., is implicated in a security report that shows that he helped a cartel move a truckload of cocaine. Then, Albuquerque has tried to criminalize homelessness with an ordinance passed in November 2017 that prohibits interactions between drivers and pedestrians who are on medians and freeway entrances, including panhandling. The New Mexico ACLU has filed a lawsuit against Albuquerque in federal court. And then, vast inequality is on the rise in the nation's capital as longtime residents are forced out, over-policed, and denied a decent education. What are the city's priorities, and what does it say about the state of the country? Finally, we look at the worst and most misleading headlines of the week. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear.
But first, we turn to the major news story. The New York Times reported today that President Trump decided last June to fire Special Counsel Robert Mueller because his investigation had moved beyond Russia and alleged collusion. According to the story, White House Counsel Dan McGahn, however, said he would resign, and Trump then backed off. Many observers say that firing Mueller would have led to a constitutional crisis. Donald Trump says this is all fake news. We are joined from New York by Joe Loria. He is a journalist and political commentator and author of the book How I Lost by Hillary Clinton. Joe Loria, welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me back.
Well, there's different parts to this story. According to the New York Times, Trump was getting ready to fire Mueller. And then I listened to the radio this morning on another, like NPR and other places, and nobody could verify that he actually did want to fire or had decided to fire Mueller. But all the stories and the news coverage and the commentary was, but if he had, what would be the impact? Which is, in other words, we take something that's not true or not necessarily true.
Although, I'm going to interrupt you for 1 second and say the New York Times is saying that they have what they're calling firsthand information. So that has to be someone who was in the room.
Who's the source?
They won't say.
Okay. That's okay. Joe Loria, anyway, let's get your take on it.
Well, that is the key issue. Who is the source? And if there's only one source, too, that weakens it. And but I wouldn't be surprised because there's been so much leaking going on, obviously, since the inauguration a year ago, that one more leak coming from someone supposedly loyal to Trump would not be surprising. That he wanted to fire Mueller would not be surprising, too, but it could have been some impetuous decision that he made, and he was apparently talked out of it, which was the wise decision if, in fact, he wanted to do that. So the story might be just a big storm in the proverbial cup, you know, cup of tea.
Wait a second. An impetuous decision?
Well, right. Maybe Imagine. The first one.
Yeah, Donald Trump making an impetuous decision. But Trump says it's fake news. Of course, the Republican apologists for Trump are now arguing that what would be wrong with firing Mueller if they make the argument that Mueller was in fact biased? In other words, not an impartial prosecutor. Mueller, before James Comey was the FBI director, was the FBI director. And there's been all kinds of improprieties in both, it was certainly with the FBI, missing text messages. The NSA lost all sorts of emails. It appears that the FBI was talking to Christopher Steele, who was hired by Hillary Clinton after he had been hired through Republican rivals of Trump, that Steele was the one who talked to the FBI about alleged collusion between Trump and Russia. In other words, you could see why within the Trump campaign, people would say, well, this isn't unbiased, that this is, in fact, a witch hunt. There's been, after all these months, no actual hard evidence of Russia collusion. I mean, maybe there will be some, but I would have thought we would have seen it by now. So anyway, maybe Trump would want to get rid of Mueller, as you're saying, but let's think about it from a political point of view. Trump also thought it was a good idea to fire James Comey. Donald Trump actually thought he was going to be applauded by the Democrats because they were hating James Comey. So he fired him back in May of 2017. And immediately the Democrats said, see, you're trying to cover up the Russia probe. You're trying to distract from the Russia probe. He really thought the Democrats, because they hated Comey and thought he was responsible for the loss of Hillary Clinton, would applaud. In other words, Donald Trump was making some really, really bad decisions. And if he hadn't fired Comey, there might not be a special counsel.
Well, what is Donald Trump's background in politics before being elected to the highest office in the land? Zero. So he was completely naive and he misread that totally. He didn't help himself by going on TV and telling Lester Holt that he fired Comey over the quote unquote Russia thing, which could mean a number of things. It could just mean he wanted to relieve the pressure on him that was being put over Russia and that Comey was the head of the spear of that. Or it could have meant that he was obstructing justice, which of course is what the Democrats say and what they want Mueller to find. So he didn't help himself there. I think what we're seeing right now, Brian, is two competing conspiracy theories. On the one hand, the Russiagate, as you pointed out, clearly there's been no real evidence. Nothing has stuck. We could talk 2 hours about that. All the Don Jr. meeting, Flynn, the DNC hack, Manafort and Papadopoulos, none of that has nailed Russia for hacking the emails or for blackmailing or bribing Trump or in any way helping Trump to win the election. As you say, that could come out, but it's been a year and a half. We haven't seen it yet. The other theory is that there's been a coup d'etat against Trump. It started during the campaign when he won the nomination, certainly accelerated after he won the election. There's not a lot of evidence for that, but there's some, and it's in one way, I think, more plausible than the Russiagate one. Because it looked like a coup from the start with these leaks that were coming out mysteriously. And now the evidence that is coming forward are these text messages which were deleted, which we now know the Inspector General at the Justice Department has recovered them, which was not a difficult thing to do, apparently. So the Congress, House Intelligence Committee is going to get those text messages, and that's very important evidence perhaps in there. The other one is this Nunes memo, the memo of the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee that has not been released yet. It may not be. It could be under the speech and debate clause of the Constitution. Any member of Congress can reveal even classified information without fear of arrest or questioning. We don't know if that's going to happen. But what we see is a preemptive attempt on the Democrats' part to destroy whatever evidence might be in the Nunes memo and in these new text messages between Lisa Page and Peter Strzok. We have Adam Schiff is writing his own memo now to counter that.
And let's just for the audience that may be not following all of these things closely, let's go over just real briefly. Nunes is the Republican head of the House committee.
The Intelligence Committee.
The Intelligence Committee. Strozek was an FBI agent assigned, including during the Mueller probe, about Hillary Clinton's email, but also about Trump's collusion with Russia. And the emails or text messages he was sending to Lisa Page, who apparently he was having a romantic affair with, signified and showed absolute bias against Trump. They even at one point talked about the investigation being an insurance policy against Trump. He was let go by Mueller when the text messages came up. So these are the characters that we're talking about. I want to go to the New York Times article real quickly, John, because this is where the story comes from. They say that Trump was making the argument when he wanted to fire Mueller that Mueller had three conflicts of interest that disqualified him from overseeing the investigation. Again, these are two anonymous sources, but the Times is quoting them or, you know, using them as their source. First, he claimed that a dispute years ago over fees at Trump National Golf Club in Sterling, Virginia, had prompted Mueller, the FBI director at the time, to resign his membership. So that, I mean, come on, that's funny.
Yeah, that's just, they just made that up.
But I mean, it's also funny that Mueller is actually a member of Trump's.
A Trump golf course.
That's funny.
I couldn't believe it when I read it.
The president also said that Mueller could not be impartial because he had most recently worked for the law firm that previously represented the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. I mean, that too shows the closeness. All of these people are actually buds. They're really working together. I mean, there's a falling out among the elites going on in Washington, D.C. They're hurling charges at each other, but they go to the same country clubs. They belong to the same country clubs. They hire the same corporate lawyers when their families are in trouble, like what happened with Jared Kushner. And of course, Mueller worked for that law firm. And finally, the president said Mr. Mueller had been interviewed to return as the FBI director the day before he was appointed special counsel in May 2017. Okay, so let's just, Joe Lurie, let's dissect some of that. Does any of that amount to a significant conflict of interest?
I don't think so. I mean, the golf club.
It doesn't sound like it to me.
No, not at all. I think if Trump wanted to fire him, it was because he's bothered by this constant drumbeat of allegations on Russia. And there might be something Trump is hiding in financial matters, some financial crimes. May have nothing to do with Russiagate, as we saw with the Paul Manafort indictment. It preceded the campaign. So maybe Trump's nervous about that. He just doesn't want it. I don't imagine any president would want a special counsel going over his past like this. So, no, the golf course thing, frankly, I don't think that makes the grade as far as a conflict of interest, whether he was working for the firm that represented Jared Kushner. I mean, Trump should be happy about that thing, right?
That's right.
It's a conflict of interest that works for Trump.
Right.
Joe, I want to ask you a question, too. We've said on this show from the very beginning that nothing was going to come out of this so-called Russian collusion investigation, and certainly nothing has come out, that there would be a lot of throwaway felonies, people would be charged with obstruction of justice and making a false statement and failure to register for this, that, or the other thing. But we also know that the day that Manafort and Gates were indicted in the federal district of the District of Columbia, that there were four other indictments that came down that still remain sealed. Based on what you've seen so far that's made its way to the press, can you speculate as to who else might already have been indicted?
To be honest with you, no. And there's not been a lot of talk about that,
no.
Funny enough.
No, there really
hasn't.
It's
become very quiet because at first it appeared that it might be Tony Podesta. Tony Podesta is the brother of John Podesta. The two brothers formed the Podesta Group. John Podesta is no longer with the Podesta Group, but he was Hillary Clinton's campaign chairperson. It was his emails that were hacked that, you know, brought so much embarrassment to the Clinton campaign and to him personally. But there was a lot of talk that Tony Podesta was actually the subcontractor for Paul Manafort, again, showing how this Washington web of political and corporate elites, which appear to be at war with each other, are actually all friends. They're all business connections. It's a very, very sort of incestuous situation here in Washington. We don't know if Tony Podesta is one of them, but who knows? I mean, maybe Mueller needs that just to show that it's not a partisan affair.
That's right.
I mean,
well, frankly, as an independent observer of this, I'm sitting back and enjoying watching both sides trying to destroy each other with these two competing conspiracy theories, whether it was Russia that stole the election or whether this was a coup led by not just the FBI. We should look at John Brennan, Obama's CIA, and also Mr. Clapper, the DNI at the time. They may have played, if there was this coup from a deep state, which is being ridiculed today by CNN and others. You know, CNN is calling this the conspiracy theory, but Russiagate actually is a fact. They don't even say it's alleged. So we should look at Brennan, and I don't know if we're ever going to find out about what Brennan's role and Clapper's role may have been in organizing what could have been this coup. All we're going to get are these text messages that have now been recovered and this memo from Nunes. But I'd like to see both the parties at each other's throats. I think both of them have let the American public down for years now, neither one of them representing the interests of the majority of American people. To see both major parties in trouble as they are and trying to it's all devolved into a partisan screaming match right now. Any serious independent neutral investigation to either of these are going to be dismissed by either side. Facts don't seem to matter, and they may never matter in this. That's very disturbing, I think, that we've reached this point. But if there's a destruction, a weakening of both parties, it could be an opening for a new kind of politics in the U.S., hopefully.
Yeah, and now the Senate Intelligence Committee, though, is trying to haul Jill Stein in the Green Party. Ridiculous. But, of course, I think Joe might be right. Washington elites have formed a circular firing squad.
Yep.
We don't know how that turns out, but you can kind of guess. Anyway, we've been joined from New York by Joe Loria. He is a journalist and political commentator and author of the book, How I Lost by Hillary Clinton. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
President Trump spoke in Davos, Switzerland today at the World Economic Forum. He emphasized his America First policy and also softened his previously strong anti-globalization stance that had earned him support from workers around the country. We're joined from Norfolk, Connecticut by Patrick Lawrence. He is the author of Time No Longer, Americans After the American Century, and he's a columnist at The Nation. Good to have you back, Patrick.
Pleasure, both of you.
So, Patrick, the president softened some of this language. What should we take from that? Is it that he was playing to his audience, or do you think we're going to see this played out as some kind of change in policy?
Well, the boring answer is it's hard to say.
That was boring. Wait a second. That was boring. But you may be right.
Look, all politicians play to their audiences. What I like about this speech is, in our American context, and also in the context of the European environment, okay, is people are listening to Trump to see what he has to say. It gets rather boring over here to read about his habits with cheeseburgers and TV screens. Nobody engages what this man has to say. Now maybe we can see, all right? That's my view of it. Is he coming closer in on globalization? Probably, but I think he authentically wants to make a difference in this following way. He's one of the only leaders out there. You got to line him up with people like Corbyn and Sanders, which is very unlikely. He's the only leader of a major country now who is actually willing to come out and say globalization has not served too many people. I want to hear more.
Yeah, during the campaign, he was used the formulation "the false song of globalism."
Not a bad phrase.
But Patrick, let's talk about. By the way, the Davos elite, they might not like Trump. They might think he's a clown. I mean, I'm just guessing. But they actually like his tax policy because it's so pro-corporate, so pro-ultra-rich. And they like that. And they also like his war against regulations because regulations mean that there's some limitation on corporate power when it comes to destroying the environment or providing basic rights for workers. So I actually think Donald Trump could be well-liked in Davos.
Well, yes. I don't want your listeners to misconstrue what I just said. He's a radically pro-business person. I'll add to the list of what people like the stock indices, right? Everything's going in the right direction, but you know we live with short-termism now. Okay, an analyst I know who is actually quite close to Trump's people say, look, the tax thing passed, the deregulation drift, we are in for a sugar high, the like of nothing we have known in a long, long time. And we all know what happens after those. So I don't think Trump is moving in the direction his voters may have assumed. I don't see that. But let's see. I like what he is saying. I want trade agreements to work for more people and not just corporations, right? I do like that.
It's interesting to me that progressive outlets like Vox, for example, are saying that the speech was conciliatory. And to quote them, it says, the speech was an attempt to try to kiss up to the global elites rather than telling them to kiss off, but there were no fireworks. Would you agree with that?
Look, yes, but with a qualification. I think those who held expectations that Trump was going to follow through with some grand confrontation with corporate capital just were, the scales need to drop. That was never really going to happen. One wanted to see just to take one example, Trump has harped on this question of American manufacturing jobs for decades. Most press people writing about him don't read enough or care enough to go into the history and see that. He's quite sincere about that, right? I want to see that kind of policy, trade agreements that are more than deregulation regimes, which is what TPP was. I'm pleased as can be that he sank TPP, right? Or at least...
Well, it was a bit dead. I mean, it was like driving a nail straight into the heart of a corpse, no?
Well, yes, it was tipping over. I mean, in the course of last year's campaigns, many of your listeners will remember, even Hillary gold standard Clinton had to back away from it. But Trump's now got this position on these trade agreements in the White House, right? We should mention radical tariffs on solar panels and other such components. These can get a little scary pretty quickly. I mean, we've all read that could, rather than save jobs, cost tens of thousands of them. We need to see, right? So Trump is, as he always has been, a hard read. Was he conciliatory to Davos man, we might say? Well, he was in Davos. I'm not quite sure how, you know, all that far from.
I think Trump is Davos man. I think that
I agree.
I actually think that I don't think Trump ever expected to be president, but he was promoting his brand, and he was playing to a particular part of the audience, which found his arguments against globalization wildly popular because big parts of America and big parts of all of the industrialized world have been hollowed out as a consequence of offshoring and all these other things, which
I live amid these, not very far from half a dozen red brick towns that are just quite sad to drive through. May I put it this way? He identified the problem in a way I find extremely constructive. I am not at all sure that he has the right solutions. In fact, in many cases, I don't think he does.
You know, and that's well, not that your first point is the reason why he won a majority of union households in the Rust Belt states. That's why states like Pennsylvania, that had been blue for something like four cycles,
also had voted for Obama
Yeah. Right. That's why Pennsylvania flipped, and Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin. Because there are people who are afraid of globalization, or people who blame globalization for their inability to secure a job, or for the fact that manufacturing plants are moving out of their states.
You would say, look, not only did he win the election last year, which is obviously of paramount importance, but John, going to your point, it's quite important to understand how he won it and where he won it. You know, these dates that you rattled off.
Yeah, here's a quote, and it's not Karl Marx, so I'm gonna that means you have many other people to choose from. We can have democracy in this country, or we can have great wealth concentrated in the hands of a few, but we can't have both. Not Karl Marx. Who is it?
I don't know.
Okay.
Keynes or somebody like that?
No, it's a totally unfair question. It's for
Nixon. Somebody really uncanny.
Former U.S. Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis. Now, a new report from Oxfam, the global charity organization, found that 82% of all of the world's wealth created in 2017, in our last year, 82%, went to the global top 1%. Those are the Davos men and a few Davos women. The poorer half of humanity, 3.7 billion people, got nothing.
Huh.
Now, who does all the work? Who goes to work every day?
That's
it's
right.
Not the 1%. It's not they through the mechanisms of ownership and through the mechanisms of globalization and ownership, they accumulate 82% of the new wealth in 2017, and the people who went to work every day, for the most part, got nothing.
Let me introduce a word here, and I will dilate on it very briefly. The word is demand, okay? When Brandeis said that, it was a given of economics that you had that sustainable growth required sustained demand. How do you do that? Well, one can be a straight-out Fordist. Pay enough so people can buy the products you're producing. I don't know when exactly this equation between productivity and wages broke, but nobody pays any attention to it anymore. And I think this is our fundamental problem. Their demand is weakening, right? The way demand, such as it is now maintained by shoving everybody into credit card debt. And credit card debt's defaults jumped 16% last year. Did you know that? The figures just came out. What I like about Trump is he seems to be at least modestly mindful of demand, right? I think demand is the principle of maintaining demand goes a long way to explaining Brandeis's remark. Do you not agree?
Well, I think Brandeis, and I think people who are protesting outside of Brandeis, outside of Davos now, I mean, I think people are motivated by this fundamental sense of social justice. And I don't really believe that Donald Trump has a social justice bone in his body. I mean, he might, but I lived in New York for 30 years. It just didn't reveal itself. Maybe I wasn't, I don't know.
Putting it mildly.
John, I think we're out of time.
Yes, we are out of time. We were joined from Norfolk, Connecticut by Patrick Lawrence. He is the author of Time No Longer, Americans After the American Century, and he's a columnist at The Nation magazine. Please stay tuned. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
In the last 24 hours, Turkey has unleashed some aggressive threats against the United States. Turkey's deputy prime minister said pointedly that if the United States wants to, quote, avoid a confrontation with Turkey, which neither they nor Turkey want, the way to this is clear. They must cut support given to terrorists. Meanwhile, the Kurds in Afrin have taken a big hit from Turkish forces. What is Turkey's goal in threatening the United States, and will it make good on its threats to, quote, cleanse Afrin of Kurds? We are joined from London by Ambassador Peter Ford. He is the former UK ambassador to Syria, and from Ottawa, Canada, by Steve Gowans, a journalist and author of Washington's Long War on Syria. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Peter Ford, Ambassador Ford, Just help frame what's going on real briefly for our audience, if you would.
Well, this latest crisis was precipitated by the recent U.S. Move to announce that they were going to stay long-term in the northern, mainly Kurdish areas of Syria, that they were going to build up the Kurdish-dominated SDF militia, the objective of which was to hold the area against Assad, and also that they were going to create a border force which would not only protect the southern border against Assad, but also the northern border against Turkey. And this set fire to the haystack because it precipitated the Turkish attack. This attack had been coming for some time, but it was this very unwise American pronouncement that triggered it.
Now, I wonder how long the Turks can keep up a foreign policy that has them at loggerheads with so many neighbors. The Turks are having a tough time with the Syrian government. They're constantly going back and forth with the Iraqis, with the Greeks. Relations with the Russians go hot and cold. Is there an overall strategy to Turkey's foreign policy, or is it reactive or reactionary to daily events? Ambassador Ford, can you start with that, and then we'll go over to Steve Gowans?
I think it's very simple. They have the Turkish government has one overriding priority, security in the south against what it sees as rightly or wrongly as Kurdish subversion and insurrection, both within Turkey's borders and from across those borders in Syria and Iraq. And everything else is subsidiary. And the Turkish government has, by and large, the support of most of the Kurdish people on this. So anything else, like relations with Russia or America or whatever, is secondary. It's also very important that Turkey is in a position to call the shots on this issue, given the geography and the military situation.
Steve Gowans, Afrin, the area that's being contested, being invaded by Turkey, I mean, has been essentially an autonomous zone since the war in Syria, about a year after the war in Syria began, since 2012. What's the Turkish objective here? Just a demonstration of might, or are they intending to incorporate Afrin into a Turkish ongoing sphere of influence?
Well, they would assert that they want to. Yes, that would be a good way to put it. An ongoing Turkish sphere of influence. They certainly say that once their operations are complete, or the objective of the operation is to take control, but then to turn the territory over to their Syrian allies, which happen to be essentially, Islamist forces, including Al-Qaeda by another name.
Yeah, and again, Steve, help us or help the audience understand. I know you don't have a crystal ball, but here's the Deputy Prime Minister of Turkey threatening basically the United States, which is really quite something given the fact that the United States and Turkey are both member states of the U.S.-led military alliance NATO. Both, as a consequence of NATO membership, have vowed to protect each other in the event of any sort of attack from an outside force. I mean, how grievous of a split is this going on right now inside of NATO and between U.S. and Turkey?
Well, I think this split has happened, has existed for a while. It's just become exacerbated. It's become exacerbated because from the Turks' perspective, they've been repeatedly betrayed by the United States, which has broken promises to Turkey about the alliance. They said that the Syrian Democratic Force, which I'll call the YPG because that's who it's dominated by, the U.S. said the YPG would not cross the Euphrates River. It did. They assured the Turks that it would withdraw it stayed. They said that the YPG would refrain from promoting PKK ideology, PKK, the group that the Turkish government denounces as, or the Kurdish national group it denounces as terrorist group. The U.S. provided assurances that the YPG would not promote PKK ideology outside of Kurdish areas. It didn't. So from the Turk perspective, there have been many betrayals by the United States. The assurances given to Turkey have proved to be vacuous.
Yeah, Ambassador Ford, when I'm looking at the map, you can see there's Idlib in the northwest part of Syria under the control of armed groups, many of whom have been supported by Turkey over the years. There's also Afrin, which is what we're talking about now, Azaz. Further east is Manbij, Jarablus, and then there's the Euphrates River. And east of the Euphrates, you have basically YPG, that's the Kurds, made up under the banner or the rubric of the Syrian Democratic Forces, along with the Americans. Are we looking at the de facto partitioning of Syria now as the war comes to an end, meaning northwest Syria goes to Turkey and the northeast part of Syria goes to the Americans and the YPG? Is that what's happening?
It's what some might like, but it's not what's quite going to happen. I think what Turkey is after is a strip of territory, what they call a safe zone, 20 or so miles deep, all the way along the northern border, separating Turkey from the mainly Kurdish areas of northern Syria. So they are, and they announced this today, they're going to march east towards the Iraqi border. And I believe their objective is to create this strip. They will install a militia to their liking, which will be predominantly Arab forces, some of which, as Steve said, will be affiliated with Al-Qaeda. And they will act as Turkey's proxy militia in northern Syria. But this is only going to be a narrow strip. The Turks have no ambitions to go down to the Euphrates. What the United States would like, it appears, is to create a Kurdish statelet in that triangle. But this isn't going to happen either for reasons that we can go into in a moment, perhaps.
Well, let's go into them now. I mean, what's the main reasons that this won't happen?
Because the Turks have just administered a wonderful lesson to the Kurds that they need protection from Assad. And indeed, today, the local authority in Afrin appealed to the government of Syria in Damascus to come to their rescue and to assert the sovereignty of the Syrian state over its northern borders. Now, this is a position that the Kurds only 48 hours ago were rejecting when the Russians made them an offer, hand over the reins of power to Syria, and we'll protect you against the Turks. The Kurds turned this down, and now it's too late. They are appealing to Damascus. No, the Americans, by kicking this whole thing off, have scored an own goal, because it's been a reminder, a salutary lesson to the Kurds that they can't trust the Americans, that they must fear Turkey much more than Damascus, and that the least bad outcome for them is to go back into the protective bosom of the Syrian state.
Steve Gallens, I suppose I can understand Turkey's desire for border security. We could all understand the desire for border security. Turkey's got a 540-mile border with Syria. But does Turkey really just want a buffer zone? Or does Turkey have any larger designs on Syrian territory? A third question there is, Is the Turkish policy to push the Kurds out, or is it something more sinister than that?
Well, I could only speculate. I would say in the near term, certainly the most urgent requirement on the part of the Turks is to push the Kurds out, or at least to weaken the PKK and its affiliates in Syria. Does it have a broader agenda regarding Syria? Perhaps. I mean, certainly one would have argued that in 2011, given the Turkish support for the Syrian or defensive forces, or the so-called rebels, or the Islamists.
Ambassador Ford, Rex Tillerson announced, you know, the U.S. is in Syria to stay. Of course, that's not legal. They've not been invited in. There is a sovereign government in Syria. They are not authorized by the UN Security Council to use force in the another member state of the United Nations. It's clearly illegal, but nonetheless, the U.S. does lots of illegal things, and in most cases, it succeeds in getting its way, or at least doing what it wants to do if it means retaining occupation forces. It's something of the 700-pound gorilla sits wherever it wants to sit. But here it seems that it can only do that to the extent that other forces actually tolerate the presence of the United States. The United States can't send huge numbers of troops, hundreds of thousands of troops to Syria. That's not viable. The American public would not stand for that. Air power alone, while it can create a lot of suffering on the ground, it isn't decisive militarily, not in this case anyway. Will the U.S. stay forever? Or in a secondary question to that, is Russia willing to accommodate the U.S. In Syria in some way?
Well, I think the U.S. is facing imminent humiliation because the Turks have made clear that they're going to march on Manbij, where there is a large U.S. Base with reportedly 2,000 U.S. troops. Turkey has more or less given an ultimatum to the United States to remove those troops before it walks in.
So it's not a rhetorical flourish, in other words, when we heard the words of the Deputy Prime Minister.
This is deadly serious. I think the United States military commanders will be taking this very seriously, and they will have to slink away. They'll slink away or face taking casualties. This is a matter of existential importance to Turkey, but not of existential importance to the United States.
And of existential importance, of course, to the Kurds then. What will happen to the Kurds if, I mean, the Turkish military is the second biggest military inside of NATO. If they're determined to march east to Manbij, if the Americans slink away, what happens?
Then this strip, 20, 30 miles deep, will be created by Turkey. This is all so reminiscent of what happened in Lebanon a couple of decades ago when the Israelis marched in and left behind a Christian militia led by one Colonel Lahad. And this went on for about 10 years before the 2006 war, when it was brought to an end. And then the forces of Hezbollah and the Lebanese army took back control of what was always Lebanese territory.
I can tell you also that once the Turks move into territory, they don't leave. They moved into northern Cyprus, took the northern third of the island on August 9th, 1974, and they're still there. Despite we're coming up on, 45 years of UN negotiations, they're still there. And if they believe that their security is being threatened, whether it's by the Kurds in northern Syria or by the Syrian government, they'll take that buffer zone and they won't leave.
Well, but sorry if I may come in. Remember that they're planning to leave a militia behind, not Turkish forces. And in due course, I would expect the Syrian state to assert itself against that pro-Turkish militia of jihadis.
Go ahead, Steve Gowans. If just a preface before you go ahead. That would mean, let's just play this out step by step. Here you have the United States sort of brazenly, and as Ambassador Ford is suggesting, stupidly, saying that there's going to be this big border force made up of Syrian Democratic Forces, which is really the Kurds, which draws in and must draw in the Turks. The Turks are now moving east towards Manbij. The Americans have 2,000 troops there. They're working with the Kurds, but the Americans will perhaps, what we're hearing, pull back because they can't afford to face the Turkish military forces. Then as a consequence, the Turks leave behind a militia, a pro-militia force of Arabs mainly, including Al-Qaeda. But then once they pull back to that more narrow border along the northern part of Syria, southern part of Turkey, then the Syrian Arab army, meaning the Syrian government, comes back to retake that area. And if they do, which they will, presumably, the goal or the sort of vision of a Kurdish autonomous region, that might be thus wiped out entirely. Again, as a result of perhaps just very, very bad decision-making on the part of a number of the players here, including the United States and perhaps including the Kurdish forces. Steve Gowans, go ahead.
Well, I guess time will tell. We'll see. I'm not as optimistic about the United States slinking away with its tail between its legs. It was pointed out that Turkey doesn't leave. Well, the United States doesn't leave very many places either. It's been in Korea for 70 years and has no intention of leaving. And that's not
Beirut, Steve. Beirut, Steve.
Beirut, he's saying. The Americans did leave Beirut.
Yes, I'm not saying that they don't. There aren't some places they leave, but I mean, if we consider the U.S. goals in Syria are related to two of their principal enemies, as defined in the current national security strategy and defense strategy, which is Russia and Iran. I mean, largely, much of what's going on or U.S. goals are being driven by their goals with respect to those two countries. I can't see them easily giving up the territory that they have taken from ISIS using Kurd forces and simply retreating.
Well, okay, so let's just, Ambassador Ford, you're a close observer there. Are the Turks, even if the Americans don't want to give up, do the Turks have with them sufficient military forces compared to what the U.S. and what the U.S. combined with the Kurds have to make it improbable that the U.S. would be able to stay and not retreat?
Well, look, I'm only saying that the U.S. forces are quite likely to make a tactical retreat of a few miles. Remember, I believe that the Turkish aspirations don't go deeper than a strip of 20 or 30 miles. All the American forces will have to do is withdraw deeper into Kurdish-controlled territory. And I agree that they're not going to be dislodged from that any time soon. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that they are, if they're wise, going to leave Manbij town. That's all I'm saying. And it will, the U.S. will continue to try to play this card of the Kurdish, largely Kurdish-controlled area. It's still a huge area of Syria that includes, even if Turkey grabs a slice of it, that includes the important oil fields. So there's still going to be a lot to play for. But the bottom line, the bottom line here is that if the United States really wants the Iranians to leave Syria, then they must give up any idea of leaving U.S. boots on the ground.
Brian, has the U.S. government, this is going to sound naive, but I'm totally serious. Has the U.S. government articulated what its policy is with its troops in northern Syria? You know, we've got these 2,000 troops that are already there. Rex Tillerson for about 6 hours said we were going to send another something like 30,000 troops and then walk that back. But do we know why exactly U.S. troops are in northern Syria?
Well, I'll tell you what I think, and then I'm going to ask Steve to answer also about what he thinks. I mean, I think if you look back to 2011, after the fall of Gaddafi, the United States was quite convinced by just saying Assad must go, Assad must go, and having Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and Qatar of functioning both as allies and as proxies for a Western effort to overthrow the Assad government, that it would fall, that it would go, it would be defeated. And for a while, it looked like it might be defeated. Then we had the intervention not only of Iran and Hezbollah fighters from Lebanon, but the, I believe, decisive intervention on the part of Russia, which came in and said the Syrian government is the indispensable factor for the defeat of ISIS and al-Qaeda. And it made it quite clear from then on that the Syrian government wasn't going to fall. And so the American policy of 2011 to 2014 essentially collapsed. It was not realizable. And since then, the U.S. has established what I would say is an ad hoc policy, reactive policy, the making the best of bad circumstances for the U.S. plans. And what's happened is, especially with the Astana talks in Kazakhstan, where you have Iran, Turkey, and Russia as the guarantors of a peace process as the opposition was being defeated in Syria, the Americans seemed to be irrelevant. Well, they were irrelevant. They weren't part of that process. And as a consequence, the only way America could think to be relevant again was to send troops. And they had in the Kurds a willing partner. So American troops mean America retains relevance. And then it says to Russia and to Turkey and to the other players, you can't ignore us. We have to be part of a post-war Syria arrangement. Anyway, that's what I think. It is ad hoc. I think it is reactive, which is, John, what you're suggesting. Steve Gowans, what's your take on that?
Well, okay, you could call it ad hoc. You can call it reactive. I mean, they're obstinate. They have goals for Syria. They've developed another plan. I mean, the first plan broke down. It doesn't work. Now they have a second plan, and the second plan was using the Kurds as the tip of the spear. The reason they have troops in northern Syria is that they have special operations forces, essentially using the Kurds as their boots on the ground. The Kurdish force isn't really much of a military force without U.S. air support, without U.S. artillery, and there's some artillery, and without special operations controllers or people to manage them. The larger story here is about the U.S. strategy in Syria, and that strategy is one of continuing their presence in Syria, in northwest Syria, using the Kurds to take control of the oil and gas resources, providing reconstruction, which they've talked about. They're trying to reconstruct that area, the area that has been captured from ISIS, which they have no intention of giving back to the Syrian government, providing reconstruction there and denying any kind of reconstruction in the areas controlled by the Syrian government, or certainly denying them their Syria's oil and gas reserves, and they're also going to hold Syria's main electrical dam. And they've been quite open about what their goals are. They're not loud about it, but they're quite open about it. They want to ensure that the UN-led process transitions away from the leadership of Assad, and the way they intend to do that is to use military garrisons, U.S. military garrisons in northwest Syria as a bargaining chip. That's one thing they want to do. So the objective remains. I mean, they tried various ways to achieve that objective, and the objective was to oust the Arab nationalists from Syria. And they continue to pursue that program. They're just pursuing it in a different way, using different proxies than they were previously.
Ambassador, can you weigh in on that too?
Yeah, I think that's basically right, although I'm not quite sure whether there is one U.S. policy or two, whether there is a Pentagon neocon program, which Steve has just laid out, but whether there is not also a Trump deal or incipient deal with Putin, whereby Trump is keen to get the Iranians out of Syria and Putin is ready to arrange that, provided the Americans leave. It would be an achievement for Trump to secure an end state where the Iranians leave. And if that meant giving up the Kurdish card, well, that's the whole point of holding it. But who knows what's going on in Washington, or whether Trump can hold to a single strategy. I agree, it must be on balance more likely that the Pentagon boneheaded, obstinate policy will prevail.
Okay, Steve Gowans, we have 1 minute left. Just your reaction to that. I mean, is there one U.S. policy? Are there two? And of course, in our last minute, tell us, if you have an opinion, what you think the Russians are trying to achieve from the point of view of Russia's own interests or perceived interests.
Well, regarding the Americans, I believe they have some objectives. The objectives don't change with administrations, but the way in which they might achieve those objectives can change by administration, and there can be disagreements within the U.S. government about how to achieve those objectives. And changing circumstances can lead to different tactics and means to achieve them, but the objectives remain the same. And the objective is to oust the Arab nationalists from Damascus and to weaken the Iranians, and also to weaken the Russians as far as they can do so. I'm not sure I can offer much beyond that.
Okay, let's leave it there. We're completely out of time now. We've been joined from London by Ambassador Peter Ford. He's the former UK ambassador to Syria, and from Ottawa, Canada, by Steve Gowans. He's a journalist and author of Washington's Long War on Syria. After a short break, we'll be back with the top stories of the day. Stay with us.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.